It's a miracle. No, no, Your Excellency. Let me guess then. The sun has risen, and a new day is upon us. Or the sea is blue. That now is the finest of all miracles. Excellency, a man is flying. What? The Emperor stopped his fan. I saw him in the air. A man, flying, with wings. I heard a voice call out of the sky, and when I looked up, there he was, a dragon in the heavens with a man in its mouth. A dragon of paper and bamboo, colored like the sun and the grass. It is early, said the Emperor, and you have just wakened from a dream. It is early, but I have seen what I have seen. Come, and you will see it too. Sit down here with me, said the Emperor. Drink some tea. It must be a strange thing, if it is true, to see a man fly. You must have time to think of it, even as I must have time to prepare myself for the sight. They drank tea. Please, said the servant at last, or he will be gone. The Emperor rose thoughtfully. Now you may show me what you have seen. They walked into a garden, across a meadow of grass, over a small bridge, through a grove of trees, and up a tiny hill. There, said the servant. The Emperor looked into the sky, and in the sky, laughing so high that you could hardly hear him laugh, was a man. And the man was clothed in bright papers and reeds to make wings and a beautiful yellow tail. And he was soaring all about like the largest bird in a universe of birds, like a new dragon in a land of ancient dragons. The man called down to them from high in the cool winds of morning, I fly! I fly! The servant waved to him, Yes! Yes! The Emperor Yan did not move. Instead, he looked at the Great Wall of China, now taking shape out of the farthest mist in the green hills. That splendid snake of stones which writhed with majesty across the entire land. That wonderful wall which had protected them for a timeless time from enemy hordes and preserved peace for years without number. He saw the town, nestled to itself by a river and a road and a hill, beginning to waken. Tell me, he said to his servant, has anyone else seen this flying man? I am the only one, Excellency, said the servant, smiling at the sky, waving. The Emperor watched the heavens another minute and then said, Call him down to me.
Ho! Come down! Come down! The Emperor wishes to see you, called the servant, hands cupped to his shouting mouth.
The Emperor glanced in all directions while the flying man soared down the morning wind. He saw a farmer early in his fields watching the sky, and he noted where the farmer stood. The flying man alit with a rustle of paper and a creak of bamboo reeds. He came proudly to the Emperor, clumsy in his rig, at last bowing before the old man. What have you done? Demanded the Emperor.
I have flown in the sky, Your Excellency, replied the man.
What have you done? Said the Emperor again.
I have just told you, cried the flyer.
You have told me nothing at all. The Emperor reached out a thin hand to touch the pretty paper and the bird-like keel of the apparatus. It smelled cool of the wind.
Is it not beautiful, Excellency?
Yes. Too beautiful.
It is the only one in the world, smiled the man. And I am the inventor.
The only one in the world?
I swear it.
Who else knows of this?
No one. Not even my wife, who would think me mad with the sun. She thought I was making a kite.
I rose in the night and walked to the cliffs far away. And when the morning breezes blew and the sun rose, I gathered my courage, Excellency, and leaped from the cliff. I flew!
but my wife does not know of it.
Well for her, then, said the emperor. Come along. They walked back to the great house. The sun was full in the sky now, and the smell of the grass was refreshing. The emperor, the servant, and the flyer paused within the huge garden. The emperor clapped his hands.
Ho, guards!
The guards came running.
Hold this man.
The guards seized the flyer. Call the executioner, said the emperor.
What's this?
Cried the flyer, bewildered.
What have I done?
He began to weep, so that the beautiful paper apparatus rustled. Here is the man who has made a certain machine, said the emperor, and yet asks us what he has created. He does not know himself. It is only necessary that he create, without knowing why he has done so, or what this thing will do. The executioner came running with a sharp silver axe. He stood with his naked, large-muscled arms ready, his face covered with a serene white mask.
One moment, said the emperor.
He turned to a nearby table, upon which sat a machine that he himself had created. The emperor took a tiny golden key from his own neck. He fitted his key to the tiny, delicate machine and wound it up. Then he set the machine going. The machine was a garden of metal and jewels. Set in motion, the birds sang in tiny metal trees. Wolves walked through miniature forests, and tiny people ran in and out of sun and shadow, fanning themselves with miniature fans, listening to tiny emerald birds and standing by impossibly small but tinkling fountains.
Is it not beautiful? Said the emperor. If you asked me what I have done here, I could answer you well. I have made birds sing. I have made forests murmur. I have set people to walking in this woodland, enjoying the leaves and shadows and songs. That is what I have done.
But, oh, emperor, pleaded the flyer on his knees, the tears pouring down his face, I have done a similar thing. I have found beauty. I have flown on the morning wind. I have looked down on all the sleeping houses and gardens. I have smelled the sea and even seen it beyond the hills from my high place. And I have soared like a bird. Oh, I cannot say how beautiful it is up there in the sky with the wind about me, the wind blowing me here like a feather, there like a fan, the way the sky smells in the morning, and how free one feels. That is beautiful, Emperor, that is beautiful too.
Yes, said the Emperor sadly, I know it must be true. For I felt my heart move with you in the air, and I wondered, what is it like? How does it feel? How do the distant pools look from so high, and how my houses and servants, like ants? And how the distant towns not yet awake?
Then spare me.
But there are times, said the emperor, more sadly still, when one must lose a little beauty if one is to keep what little beauty one already has. I do not fear you yourself, but I fear another man.
What man?
Some other man who, seeing you, will build a thing of bright papers and bamboo like this, but the other man will have an evil face and an evil heart, and the beauty will be gone. It is this man I fear.
Why? Why?
Who is to say that someday just such a man, in just such an apparatus of paper and reed, might not fly in the sky
and drop huge stones upon the Great Wall of China, said the emperor. No one moved or said a word. Off with his head, said the emperor. The executioner whirled his silver axe. Burn the kite and the inventor's body and bury their ashes together, said the emperor. The servants retreated to obey. The emperor turned to his handservant, who had seen the man flying. Hold your tongue. It was all a dream. A most sorrowful and beautiful dream. And that farmer in the distant field who also saw. Tell him it would pay him to consider it only a vision. If ever the word passes around, you and the farmer die within the hour. You are merciful, emperor. No, not merciful, said the old man. Beyond the garden wall, he saw the guards burning the beautiful machine of paper and reeds that smelled of the morning wind. He saw the dark smoke climb into the sky. No, only very much bewildered and afraid. He saw the guards digging a tiny pit wherein to bury the ashes. What is the life of one man against those of a million others? I must take solace from that thought. He took the key from its chain about his neck and once more wound up the beautiful miniature garden. He stood looking out across the land at the great wall, the peaceful town, the green fields, the rivers and streams. He sighed. The tiny garden whirred its hidden and delicate machinery and set itself in motion. Tiny people walked in forests. Tiny faces loped through sun-speckled glades in beautiful shining pelts. And among the tiny trees flew little bits of high song and bright blue and yellow color, flying, flying, flying in that small sky. Oh, said the emperor, closing his eyes, look at the birds. Look at the birds.
Zombies on a Plane by Bev Vincent. Our co-pilot, Bev Vincent, has published over 80 short stories and a few books of nonfiction, but this is his only story thus far that involves airplanes. The title was inspired by a certain movie starring Samuel L. Jackson, but you won't find a single 13-lettered epithet in the following tale. Yippee-ki-yay!
Zombies on a Plane. Read by Corey Stoll.
The guy wearing the fish t-shirt told Miles he can fly anything, and if he's lying, they're all dead. It's that simple. The guy, Barry, who looks like he's under 30, says he trained to be a pilot over there, where it all started. But he's skimpy with the details, and it sounds like an idle boast, the kind of line someone trots out in a bar late at night to impress women. If women were still hanging out in bars, that is. A lot of people said the war was a bad idea. I supported it at first, Barry says with a shrug. Never figured it would turn out like this. An understatement if Miles ever heard one. Miles met up with this small group of survivors, 19 in total counting himself, in the auditorium of an inner-city school, a place with strong doors and sturdy locks that provided temporary sanctuary. Once Barry announced he could get them airborne, Miles presented his sketchy plan. Just like that, he became their leader. We'll go someplace remote, he tells those gathered around him, apparently attracted by the aura of confidence he cultivated during 30 years in sales and middle management. A place where we'll be safe until all this is over. No one asks what they'll do if this is never over. Heading for the airport seems like their best option. The city's overrun, much of it on fire, and people are being killed in the streets. Those that aren't consumed by their attackers get up again a few seconds later to join the ravenous army of the undead. Miles wishes his plan didn't rely on the unproven skills of a guy who looks like he's never worked a day in his life. But if the others want to treat him like their leader, he's going to lead, goddammit. Under his direction, they raid the cafeteria for food and the work shed for tools and weapons. Barry also claims he can start the bus parked near the loading dock if they can't find the keys. Miles doesn't ask if he learned this trick over there, too, but Barry proves up to the task. Maybe there's hope after all. The fuel gauge on the aging school bus registers something less than a quarter of a tank. The last working gas station in the county ran dry 6 days ago, and the promised supply tankers never showed up. Probably never would. They have enough gas to reach the airport, barely. But if Barry can't figure out how to get one of those planes going, they're screwed. 17 people follow him and Barry onto the bus like rats after the Pied Piper. The bus is a piece of crap, but it runs, so long as they take it easy. Every time Barry pushes it past 50 kilometers an hour, the engine light comes on, so he eases back on the accelerator. They can't afford to break down. They haven't seen many of those abominations outside Halifax, but no place is safe. Those devils can pop up anywhere at any time, and Miles' group has only knives and axes for weapons. Like gasoline, bullets are a precious and rare commodity. 50 kilometers per hour is fast enough, though. If there's a plane with enough jet fuel to get them wherever they decide to go, it can wait for them to lumber along the highway. When he was in field sales before being forced into a desk job, Miles hated the long trek out to Stanfield International. But today he's happy to put distance between himself and the city. There's no traffic as far as the eye can see in either direction. They pass stalled vehicles on the side of the road, but when they slow to check if any occupants need help, the bus wheezes, hiccups, and threatens to stall. Barry eases it back up to 50, the only speed at which it seems content. Miles thinks he sees a head pop up behind the steering wheel of one car after they pass, but he can't be sure, and it could just as easily be one of them instead of a real person. He pushes the fleeting glimpse from his mind. It might have been a trick of the light, after all. And even if it wasn't, they can't save everyone. He's not even sure they can save themselves. Never give up, though. That's his mantra. His most rewarding sales were the ones where the other person intended to buy from a competitor, and Miles won him over with persistence and passion. He wonders what will happen after the zombies kill nearly everyone. Will they wander the planet in a futile quest for food until they fall to pieces and writhe on the ground like a child's toy with failing batteries? 7 billion zombies searching for the few remaining survivors of the human race. Then there's the fact that even if his group escapes, they won't live forever. They'll all die eventually. And when they do, the virus, or whatever it is, will bring each of them back as one of those creatures. All they can do is forestall the inevitable and hope that somewhere people are working on a solution. Mankind has survived for thousands of years. This scourge won't eradicate us, Miles thinks. Someone will find a way to cure this plague. They always do. This belief is what drives him. Otherwise, he might as well set himself on fire and be done with it. When they reach the airport, Miles tells everyone to hold on tight and orders Barry to crash the bus through the fence that separates the parking lot from the runways. The bus lurches and pulls to one side as the fence wraps itself like chainmail around the bumper and the windshield, but they make it through and onto the tarmac. There are several Airbuses and Boeings parked at the terminal, but Barry opts for a commuter jet, big enough to hold them all, but small enough that they'll be able to land it wherever they want, even on a remote airstrip designed for private aircraft. It's an Embraer ERJ-145 with a range of at least 4,000 kilometers, according to Barry. Maybe a little more, since they'll be flying light. Enough to get them far from here. But that's the catch. Where should they go? Barry releases the jet's door, which drops to reveal a set of stairs, He ducks inside and emerges a few minutes later with a set of navigational maps. Miles spreads them out on a bus seat while Barry and a former taxi driver named Gilbert hotwire a fuel truck and pull it up next to the Embraer's wing. Alfie, who in another life was a financial analyst, leans over the seat back.
How about Alaska?
We can't get that far. We could make Labrador or Northern Ontario.
Too cold, Terry, the former yoga instructor says, hugging herself.
Miles isn't surprised. She's complained about everything since she joined the group.
Snow slows them down, a barber named Phil says.
Even if that's true, they have to go someplace where they can survive, perhaps even grow crops. Also a place where they can stay in touch with the rest of the world, so they'll know when the situation improves.
Miles doesn't share his thought process with the others, though. He doesn't want them to realize he's as uncertain as they are.
Look! Emily yells. She's the youngest of their group, a teenager who has barely said a word since they left the city, concentrating instead on trying to reach someone, anyone, on her iPhone, clicking the keys with her thumbs. Miles looks in the direction of her outstretched arm. Several zombies emerge from the airport terminal, shambling across the tarmac toward them, guided by some primal instinct. Barry and Gilbert are stowing the hose on the fuel truck, so they must be finished. Miles grabs the wad of maps and dashes out onto the airstrip.
We have to go, he yells. Now!
The two men look up and see the zombies headed their way. Gilbert gets behind the wheel of the truck and drives it clear of the wing.
On board, everybody, Miles yells, and the others push past him without any further encouragement, backpacks full of food and supplies slung over their shoulders, weapons clutched in their hands.
The zombies may be slow, but they're relentless, and they've already covered almost half the distance between the terminal and the bus. Another few minutes and they'll be on them, ripping and tearing and shredding humanity's last best hope for survival.
Miles is the last one to board the jet, huffing and panting and trying to ignore the pain shooting down his left arm.
Two men, Miles thinks their names are Matt and Chet, pull the door closed while Barry heads into the cockpit. Gilbert volunteers to be the co-pilot, even though he's never flown a plane before. This is it, the moment of truth. If Barry can't get this thing started and off the ground, they're through, trapped like sardines in a tin can.
Miles leans back in his seat and tries to catch his breath. When he closes his eyes and concentrates, the pain in his chest subsides. He has only 3 pills left in a little plastic case in his front pocket, and the odds of finding a refill range between slim and none, so he isn't about to waste one now.
This will pass. This will pass. Another mantra. He looks out the window. The zombies have reached the bus and are sniffing around the open door. A moment later, they lurch toward the jet again. They know we're in here, Miles thinks. He pulls back from the small oval, not wanting to fall under their penetrating gaze. The other passengers are pressed up against the windows, watching the slow but steady procession. The cabin door is closed, so they're safe for now. But what if the creatures take a bite out of their tires before they start taxiing? Or if they're smart enough to find a way in, through the luggage compartment, perhaps? The thought no sooner enters his mind than he hears a thump coming from the underside of the aircraft. It reminds him of the sound of handlers opening or closing the cargo bay doors.
We have to get going, he yells, hoping their putative pilot can hear him.
He prays that Barry isn't sitting in a cockpit staring at the dizzying array of readouts, dials, and switches, wondering which one is the ignition key. Another thump. This one strong enough to cause the fuselage to sway.
I can't see them anymore, Alfie says. They're under the plane.
How many? Terry asks, her voice barely more than a whisper.
8, maybe 10, Alfie says. More on the way.
Miles looks out the portal window again. A second group of zombies is crossing the tarmac, at least 40 or 50 strong.
What's taking him so long? Miles mutters.
He inhales deeply, assesses the tightness in his chest, and decides that moving won't kill him. Besides, if they don't get in the air soon, a heart attack will be the least of his worries. He lunges from his seat and heads toward the cockpit. Through the door, he sees Barry flipping switches as Gilbert reads instructions from a sheet of paper on a clipboard.
Can you fly this thing or not? Miles demands, dreading the answer.
Of course, Barry says. Gilbert looks up from the checklist and shrugs. More thumps come from beneath Miles' feet. Now would be good. Reinforcements are on the way, and not for us. Barry nods, waves Gilbert off, and throws a few switches. To hell with the checklist, he says. I've got this. The small jet trembles as one engine roars to life and then the other. Miles can feel the power building, the potential energy that will get them off the ground and headed... where? In the panic and confusion, he still hasn't picked a destination. The others are expecting him to decide for them. Just get us out of here, he tells Barry. Barry pushes a lever and the jet begins to roll forward. Hope one of those things doesn't get sucked into the engine, he mutters. The thumping beneath the plane is nonstop now. There's nothing they can do about it, so Miles refuses to worry. If one of them manages to get into the luggage compartment, they'll deal with it once they're in the air. They still have their axes and knives. Most of them are part of this group because they know how to fend those creatures off. As the jet picks up speed, the thumping peters out, then stops. Miles tries to look behind the plane, but the view out the small window is limited. All he can see is the second group of zombies standing on the tarmac, staring at them like a group of well-wishers, saying, "Bon voyage." He takes a deep breath. "Everyone strapped in?" he asks. "We're about to take off." He hopes that's true, that they aren't about to hurtle off the end of the runway into the trees beyond. If that happens, the best-case scenario would be for the plane to burst into flames and consume them. That would put an end to their misery, at least. The others take their seats and fasten their belts. Miles wonders if they should be worrying about weight distribution. But Barry didn't mention anything about that, and so far he seems to know what he's doing. He picks up the navigational charts. He has to make a decision soon. The jet jerks to the left and pauses. They've reached the end of the runway. The engines roar, and the jet lunges forward, accelerating rapidly. Trees whip past the side windows. Miles leans back, waiting for the nose to rotate upward, and a few seconds later, it does just that. Gravity presses him into his seat as the small jet leaps into the air, buffeted by the invisible pressure of air beneath their wings. All the problems of the world fall away below them. If they could remain airborne forever, they'd be fine. The jet levels off a few minutes later. Out of habit, Miles' eyes are on the seatbelt sign, but Barry probably isn't worried about the niceties of commercial air travel. He undoes his seatbelt and returns his attention to the charts. He might as well close his eyes and point at a random spot. He doesn't have any information to aid his decision. Are there places where the plague hasn't yet spread? An island, perhaps, like Iceland, which is comfortably within range? Maybe Barry can pick up something on the radio. He has only one chance to get this right. The need to choose a destination before they burn up too much fuel paralyzes him. Why do they expect me to make all the decisions? All I want to do is go to sleep, he thinks. I'm so tired. Weight pushes against his chest again, the same sensation he felt during takeoff. But he shouldn't be feeling the pressure of acceleration now. They're at cruising altitude, high enough to minimize the friction of the air around them and maximize their range. He tries to inhale, but his chest is constricted. Suddenly he can't catch his breath. The heaviness is so great that his lungs refuse to expand. The others are staring out the windows like zombies. There's nothing to see, just the clouds and the occasional glimpse of the earth below. They're probably wondering what lies ahead, he thinks. What we'll find when we touch down. Miles no longer cares. He knows what lies ahead, and there's nothing he can do about it. Shooting pain immobilizes him. He can't reach the plastic case in his pants pocket or make a sound to attract anyone's attention. His breath comes in short bursts. The pressure in his chest builds like a wall of water at a dam ready to burst. He hopes the others will be prepared when he comes after them. He wonders whether zombies feel pain. It can't be worse than this. Can it?
They Shall Not Grow Old by Roald Dahl. Although best known for his books for children, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and James and the Giant Peach, among others, Dahl was also a talented short story writer. His most famous tale may be Lamb to the Slaughter, in which a woman cooks the frozen leg of lamb she murdered her husband with and then feeds it to the police. Dahl was an ace fighter pilot in World War II, surviving one crash and downing many enemy aircraft, including at least two Junkers 88s. He flew a Hawker Hurricane exactly like the one Finn flies in this story, which was originally published in Ladies Home Journal near the end of the war.
They Shall Not Grow Old, read by Christian Coulson.
The two of us sat outside the hangar on wooden boxes. It was noon. The sun was high, and the heat of the sun was like a close fire. It was hotter than hell out there by the hangar. We could feel the hot air touching the inside of our lungs when we breathed, and we found it better if we almost closed our lips and breathed in quickly. It was cooler that way. The sun was upon our shoulders and upon our backs, and all the time the sweat seeped out from our skin, trickled down our necks, over our chests and down our stomachs. It collected just where our belts were tight around the tops of our trousers, and it filtered under the tightness of our belts where the wet was very uncomfortable and made prickly heat on the skin. Our two Hurricanes were standing a few yards away, each with that patient, smug look which fighter planes have when the engine is not turning, and beyond them, the thin black strip of the runway sloped down towards the beaches and towards the sea. The black surface of the runway and the white grassy sand on the sides of the runway shimmered and shimmered in the sun. The heat haze hung like a vapor over the aerodrome. The Stag looked at his watch. "He ought to be back," he said. The two of us were on readiness, sitting there for orders to take off. The Stag moved his feet on the hot ground. "He ought to be back," he said. It was 2.5 hours since Finn had gone, and he certainly should have come back by now. I looked up into the sky and listened. There was the noise of airmen talking beside the petrol wagon, and there was the faint pounding of the sea upon the beaches, but there was no sign of an aeroplane. We sat a little while longer without speaking. "It looks as though he's had it," I said. "Yep," said the Stag. "It looks like it." The Stag got up and put his hands into the pockets of his khaki shorts. I got up too. We stood looking northwards into the clear sky, and we shifted our feet on the ground because of the softness of the tar and because of the heat. "What was the name of that girl?" said the Stag without turning his head. "Nikki," I answered. The Stag sat down again on his wooden box, still with his hands in his pockets, and he looked down at the ground between his feet. The Stag was the oldest pilot in the squadron. He was 27. He had a mass of coarse ginger hair which he never brushed. His face was pale, even after all this time in the sun, and covered with freckles. His mouth was wide and tight closed. He was not tall, but his shoulders under his khaki shirt were broad and thick, like those of a wrestler. He was a quiet person. "He'll probably be all right," he said, looking up. "And anyway, I'd like to meet the Vichy Frenchman who can get Finn." We were in Palestine fighting the Vichy French in Syria. We were at Haifa, and 3 hours before, the Stag, Finn, and I had gone on readiness. Finn had flown off in response to an urgent call from the Navy, who had phoned up and said that there were two French destroyers moving out of Beirut Harbor. "Please go at once and see where they're going," said the Navy. "Just fly up the coast and have a look and come back quickly and tell us where they're going." So Finn had flown off in his Hurricane. The time had gone by, and he had not returned. We knew that there was no longer much hope. If he hadn't been shot down, he would have run out of petrol some time ago. I looked down, and I saw his blue RAF cap, which was lying on the ground where he had thrown it as he ran to his aircraft. And I saw the oil stains on top of the cap, and the shabby bent peak. It was difficult now to believe that he had gone. He had been in Egypt, in Libya, and in Greece. On the aerodrome and in the mess, we had had him with us all of the time. He was gay and tall and full of laughter, this Finn, with black hair and a long straight nose which he used to stroke up and down with the tip of his finger. He had a way of listening to you while you were telling a story, leaning back in his chair with his face to the ceiling, but with his eyes looking down on the ground. And it was only last night at supper that he had suddenly said, "You know, I wouldn't mind marrying Nikki. I think she's a good girl." The stag was sitting opposite him at the time, eating baked beans. "You mean just occasionally," he said. Nikki was in a cabaret in Haifa. "No," said Finn. "Cabaret girls make fine wives. They're never unfaithful. There is no novelty for them in being unfaithful. That would be like going back to the old job." The stag had looked up from his beans. "Don't be such a bloody fool," he said. "You wouldn't really marry Nikki." "Nikki," said Finn with great seriousness, "comes of a fine family. She's a good girl. She never uses a pillow when she sleeps. Do you know why she never uses a pillow when she sleeps?" "No." The others at the table were listening now. Everyone was listening to Finn talking about Nikki. "Well, when she was very young, she was engaged to be married to an officer in the French Navy. She loved him greatly. Then, one day when they were sunbathing together on the beach, he happened to mention to her that he never used a pillow when he slept. It was just one of those little things which people say to each other for the sake of conversation. But Nikki never forgot it. From that time onwards, she began to practice sleeping without a pillow. One day the French officer was run over by a truck and killed. But although to her it was very uncomfortable, she still went on sleeping without a pillow, to preserve the memory of her lover." Finn took a mouthful of beans and chewed them slowly. "It is a sad story," he said. "It shows that she's a good girl. I think I would like to marry her." That was what Finn had said last night at supper. Now he was gone, and I wondered what little thing Nikki would do in his memory. The sun was hot on my back, and I turned instinctively in order to take the heat upon the other side of my body. As I turned, I saw Carmel and the town of Haifa. I saw the steep, pale green slope of the mountain as it dropped down towards the sea. And below it, I saw the town and the bright colors of the houses shining in the sun. The houses with their whitewashed walls covered the sides of Carmel, and the red roofs of the houses were like a rash on the face of the mountain. Walking slowly towards us from the grey corrugated iron hangar came the three men who were the next crew on readiness. They had their yellow May Wests slung over their shoulders, and they came walking slowly towards us, holding their helmets in their hands as they came. When they were close, the stag said, "Finn's had it." And they said, "Yes, we know." They sat down on the wooden boxes which we had been using, and immediately the sun was upon their shoulders and upon their backs, and they began to sweat. The stag and I walked away. The next day was a Sunday, and in the morning we flew up the Lebanon Valley to ground strafe an aerodrome called Rayak. We flew past Herman, who had a hat of snow upon his head. And we came down out of the sun onto Rayak, and onto the French bombers on the aerodrome, and began our strafing. I remember that as we flew past, skimming low over the ground, the doors of the French bombers opened. I remember seeing a whole lot of women in white dresses running out across the aerodrome. I remember particularly their white dresses. You see, it was a Sunday, and the French pilots had asked their ladies out from Beirut to look over the bombers. The Vichy pilots had said, "Come out on Sunday morning, and we will show you our aeroplanes." It was a very Vichy French thing for them to do. So when we started shooting, they all tumbled out and began to run across the aerodrome in their white Sunday dresses. I remember hearing Monkey's voice over the radio saying, "Give them a chance! Give them a chance!" And the whole squadron wheeled around and circled the aerodrome once, while the women ran over the grass in every direction. One of them stumbled and fell twice, and one of them was limping and being helped by a man, but we gave them time. I remember watching the small bright flashes of a machine gun on the ground, and thinking that they should at least have stopped their shooting while we were waiting for their white-dressed women to get out of the way. That was the day after Finn had gone. The next day, the stag and I sat once more at readiness on the wooden boxes outside the hangar. Paddy, a big fair-haired boy, had taken Finn's place and was sitting with us. It was noon. The sun was high, and the heat of the sun was like a close fire. The sweat ran down our necks, down inside our shirts, over our chests and stomachs. And we sat there, waiting for the time when we would be relieved. The stag was sewing the strap onto his helmet with a needle and cotton, and telling of how he had seen Nikki the night before in Haifa, and of how he had told her about Finn. Suddenly we heard the noise of an aeroplane. The stag stopped his talking and we all looked up. The noise was coming from the north and it grew louder and louder as the aeroplane flew closer, and then the stag said suddenly, "It's a hurricane." The next moment it was circling the aerodrome, lowering its wheels to land. "Who is it?" said the fair-haired Paddy. "No one's gone out this morning." Then as it glided past us onto the runway, we saw the number on the tail of the machine, H4427, and we knew that it was Finn. We were standing up now, watching the machine as it taxied towards us, and when it came up close and swung round for parking, we saw Finn in the cockpit. He waved his hand at us, grinned, and got out. We ran up and shouted at him, "Where have you been? Where in the hell have you been? Did you force land and get away again? Did you find a woman in Beirut? Finn, where in the hell have you been?" Others were coming up and crowding around him now, fitters and riggers and the men who drove the fire tender, and they all waited to hear what Finn would say. He stood there pulling off his helmet, pushing back his black hair with his hand, and he was so astonished at our behavior that at first he merely looked at us and did not speak. Then he laughed and said, "What in the hell's the matter? What's the matter with all of you?" "Where have you been?" we shouted. "Where have you been for 2 days?" Upon the face of Finn there was a great and enormous astonishment. He looked quickly at his watch. 5 past 12, he said. "I left at 11, 1 hour and 5 minutes ago." "Don't be a lot of damn fools. I must go and report quickly. The Navy will want to know that those destroyers are still in the harbor at Beirut." He started to walk away. I caught his arm. "Finn," I said quietly, "you've been away since the day before yesterday. What's the matter with you?" He looked at me and laughed. "I've seen you organize much better jokes than this one," he said. "It isn't so funny. It isn't a bit funny." And he walked away. We stood there, the stag, Paddy and I, the fitters, the riggers and the men who drove the fire engine, watching Finn as he walked away. We looked at each other, not knowing what to say or to think, understanding nothing, knowing nothing except that Finn had been serious when he spoke, and that what he said he had believed to be true. We knew this because we knew Finn, and we knew it because when one has been together as we had been together, then there is never any doubting of anything that anyone says when he's talking about his flying. There can only be a doubting of oneself. These men were doubting themselves, standing there in the sun, doubting themselves. And the stag was standing by the wing of Finn's machine, peeling off with his fingers little flakes of paint, which had dried up and cracked in the sun. Someone said, "Well, I'll be buggered." And the men turned and started to walk quietly back to their jobs. The next 3 pilots on readiness came walking slowly towards us from the grey corrugated iron hangar, walking slowly under the heat of the sun, and swinging their helmets in their hands as they came. The stag, Paddy and I walked over to the pilot's mess to have a drink and lunch. The mess was a small white wooden building with a veranda. Inside, there were two rooms, one a sitting room with armchairs and magazines and a hole in the wall through which you could buy drinks, and the other a dining room with one long wooden table. In the sitting room, we found Finn talking to Monkey, our CO. The other pilots were sitting around listening, and everybody was drinking beer. We knew that it was really a serious business, in spite of the beer and the armchairs. But Monkey was doing what he had to do, and doing it in the only way possible. Monkey was a rare man, tall, with a handsome face, an Italian bullet wound in his leg, and a casual, friendly efficiency. He never laughed out loud. He just choked and grunted deep in his throat. Finn was saying, "You must go easy, Monkey. You must help me to stop thinking that I've gone mad." Finn was being serious and sensible, but he was worried as hell. "I have told you all I know," he said. "That I took off at 11 o'clock, that I climbed up high, that I flew to Beirut, saw the two French destroyers and came back, landing at 12:05. I swear to you that that is all I know." He looked around at us, at the stag and me, at Paddy and Johnny, and the half-dozen other pilots in the room. And we smiled at him and nodded to show him that we were with him, not against him, and that we believed what he said. Monkey said, "What in the hell am I going to say to headquarters at Jerusalem? I reported you missing, now I've got to report your return. They'll insist on knowing where you've been." The whole thing was getting to be too much for Finn. He was sitting upright, tapping with the fingers of his left hand on the leather arm of his chair, tapping with quick, sharp taps, leaning forward, thinking, thinking, fighting to think, tapping on the arm of the chair, and then he began tapping the floor with his foot as well. The stag could stand it no longer. "Monkey," he said. "Monkey, let's just leave it all for a bit. Let's leave it, and perhaps Finn will remember something later on." Paddy, who was sitting on the arm of the stag's chair, said, "Yes, and meanwhile, we could tell HQ that Finn had force-landed in a field in Syria, taken 2 days to repair his aircraft, then flown home." Everybody was helping Finn. The pilots were all helping him. In the mind of each of us was the certain knowledge that here was something that concerned us greatly. Finn knew it, although that was all he knew. And the others knew it because one could see it upon their faces. There was a tension, a fine high-drawn tension in the room, because here, for the first time, was something which was neither bullets, nor fire, nor the coughing of an engine, nor burst tires, nor blood in the cockpit, nor yesterday, nor today, nor even tomorrow. Monkey felt it too, and he said, "Yes, let's have another drink and leave it for a bit. I'll tell HQ that you force-landed in Syria and managed to get off again later." We had some more beer and went into lunch. Monkey ordered bottles of Palestine white wine with the meal to celebrate Finn's return. After that, no one mentioned the thing at all. We did not even talk about it when Finn wasn't there. But each one of us continued to think about it secretly, knowing for certain that it was something important and that it was not finished. The tension spread quickly through the squadron, and it was with all the pilots. Meanwhile, the days went by, and the sun shone upon the aerodrome and upon the aircraft, and Finn took his place among us, flying in the normal way. Then one day, I think it was about a week later, we did another ground strafe of Ryak Aerodrome. There were six of us, with Monkey leading and Finn flying on his starboard side. We came in low over Ryak, and there was plenty of light flak. And as we went in on the first run, Paddy's machine was hit. As we wheeled for the second run, we saw his Hurricane wing gently over and dive straight to the ground at the edge of the aerodrome. There was a great billow of white smoke as it hit, then the flames. And as the flames spread, the smoke turned from white to black, and Paddy was with it. Immediately there was a crackle over the radio, and I heard Finn's voice, very excited, shouting into his microphone, shouting, "I've remembered it! Hello, Monkey! I've remembered it all!" And Monkey's calm, slow reply, "Okay, Finn. Okay. Don't forget it." We did our second run, and then Monkey led us quickly away, weaving in and out of the valleys, with the bare grey-brown hills far above us on either side, and all the way home, all through the half-hour's flight, Finn never stopped shouting over the RT. First he would call to Monkey and say, "Hello, Monkey! I remembered it, all of it, every bit of it." Then he would say, "Hello, Stag! I remembered it, all of it, I can't forget it now." He called me, and he called Johnny, and he called Wishful. He called us all separately over and over again, and he was so excited that sometimes he shouted too loudly into his mic, and we could not hear what he was saying. When we landed, we dispersed our aircraft, and because Finn, for some reason, had to park his at the far side of the aerodrome, the rest of us were in the operations room before him. The ops room was beside the hangar. It was a bare place, with a large table in the middle of the floor, on which there was a map of the area. There was another smaller table with a couple of telephones, a few wooden chairs and benches, and at one end the floor was stacked with Mae Wests, parachutes and helmets. We were standing there taking off our flying clothing and throwing it onto the floor at the end of the room, when Finn arrived. He came quickly into the doorway and stopped. His black hair was standing up straight and untidy because of the way in which he'd pulled off his helmet. His face was shiny with sweat, and his khaki shirt was dark and wet. His mouth was open, and he was breathing quickly. He looked as though he'd been running. He looked like a child who had rushed downstairs into a room full of grown-ups to say that the cat has had kittens in the nursery and who does not know how to begin. We had all heard him coming because that was what we had been waiting for. Everyone stopped what they were doing and stood still, looking at Finn. Monkey said, "Hello, Finn." And Finn said, "Monkey, you've got to believe this, because it's what happened." Monkey was standing over by the table with the telephones. The stag was near him, square, short, ginger-haired stag, standing up straight, holding a Mae West in his hand, looking at Finn. The others were at the far end of the room. When Finn spoke, they began to move up quietly until they were closer to him, until they reached the edge of the big map table which they touched with their hands. There they stood, looking at Finn, waiting for him to begin. He started at once, talking quickly, then calming down and talking more slowly as he got into his story. He told everything, standing there by the door of the ops room, with his yellow Mae West still on him, and with his helmet and oxygen mask in his hand. The others stayed where they were and listened. And as I listened to him, I forgot that it was Finn speaking, and that we were in the ops room at Haifa. I forgot everything and went with him on his journey, and did not come back until he had finished. "I was flying at about 20,000, he said. "I flew over Tyre and Sidon, and over the Damour River, and then I flew inland over the Lebanon hills, because I intended to approach Beirut from the east. Suddenly I flew into cloud, thick, white cloud, which was so thick and dense that I could see nothing except the inside of my cockpit. I couldn't understand it, because a moment before, everything had been clear and blue, and there had been no cloud anywhere. I started to lose height to get out of the cloud, and I went down and down, and still I was in it. I knew that I must not go too low because of the hills, but at 6,000 the cloud was still around me. It was so thick that I could see nothing, not even the nose of my machine nor the wings, and the cloud condensed on the windshield and little rivers of water ran down the glass and got blown away by the slipstream. I had never seen cloud like that before. It was thick and white right up to the edges of the cockpit. I felt like a man on a magic carpet sitting there alone in this little glass-topped cockpit, with no wings, no tail, no engine and no aeroplane. I knew that I must get out of this cloud, so I turned and flew west over the sea away from the mountains. Then I came down low by my altimeter. I came down to 500 feet, 400, 300, 200, 100, and the cloud was still around me. For a moment I paused. I knew that it was unsafe to go lower. Then quite suddenly, like a gust of wind, came the feeling that there was nothing below me. No sea, nor earth, nor anything else. And slowly, deliberately, I opened the throttle, pushed the stick hard forward, and dived. I did not watch the altimeter. I looked straight ahead through the windshield at the whiteness of the cloud, and I went on diving. I sat there pressing the stick forward, keeping her in the dive, watching the vast, clinging whiteness of the cloud, and I never once wondered where I was going. I just went. I do not know how long I sat there. It may have been minutes, it may have been hours. I know only that as I sat there and kept her diving, I was certain that what was below me was neither mountains, nor rivers, nor earth, nor sea, and I was not afraid. Then I was blinded. It was like being half asleep in bed when someone turns on the light. I came out of the cloud so suddenly and so quickly that I was blinded. There was no space of time between being in it and being out of it. One moment I was in it, and the whiteness was thick around me, and in that same moment I was out of it, and the light was so bright that I was blinded. I screwed up my eyes and held them tight closed for several seconds. When I opened them, everything was blue. More blue than anything I had ever seen. It was not a dark blue, nor was it a bright blue. It was a blue blue, a pure shining color, which I had never seen before and which I cannot describe. I looked around. I looked up above me and behind me. I sat up and peered below me through the glass of the cockpit, and everywhere it was blue. It was bright and clear like pleasant sunlight, but there was no sun. Then I saw them. Far ahead and above, I saw a long, thin line of aircraft flying across the sky. They were moving forward in a single black line, all at the same speed, all in the same direction, all close up, following one behind the other, and the line stretched across the sky as far as the eye could see. It was the way they moved ahead, the urgent way in which they pressed forward like ships sailing before a great wind. It was from this that I knew everything. I do not know why or how I knew it, but I knew as I looked at them that these were the pilots and air crews who had been killed in battle, who now, in their own aircraft, were making their last flight, their last journey. As I flew higher and closer, I could recognize the machines themselves. I saw, in that long procession, nearly every type there was. I saw Lancasters and Dorniers, Halifaxes and Hurricanes, Messerschmitts, Spitfires, Stirlings, Savoya 79s, Junkers 88s, Gladiators, Hamptons, Mackie 200s, Blenheims, Focke-Wulfs, Bowfighters, Swordfish and Heinkels. All these and many more I saw, and the moving line reached across the blue sky both to the one side and to the other until it faded from sight. I was close to them now, and I began to sense that I was being sucked towards them regardless of what I wished to do. There was a wind which took hold of my machine, blew it over, and tossed it about like a leaf, and I was pulled and sucked as by a giant vortex towards the other aeroplanes. There was nothing I could do, for I was in the vortex and in the arms of the wind. This all happened very quickly, but I remember it clearly. I felt the pull on my aircraft becoming stronger. I was whisked forward faster and faster, and then suddenly I was flying in the procession itself, moving forward with the others, at the same speed and on the same course. Ahead of me, close enough for me to see the color of the paint on its wings, was a swordfish, an old Fleet Air Arms swordfish. I could see the heads and helmets of the observer and the pilot as they sat in their cockpits, the one behind the other. Ahead of the swordfish there was a Dornier, a flying pencil, and beyond the Dornier there were others which I could not recognize from where I was. We flew on and on. I could not have turned and flown away even if I had wanted to. I do not know why, although it may have been something to do with the vortex and with the wind, but I knew that it was so. Moreover, I was not really flying my aircraft. It flew itself. There was no maneuvering to reckon with, no speed, no height, no throttle, no stick, no nothing. Once I glanced down at my instruments and saw that they were all dead, just as they are when the machine is sitting on the ground. So we flew on. I had no idea how fast we went. There was no sensation of speed, and for all I know it was a million miles an hour. Now I come to think of it, I never once during that time felt either hot or cold, or hungry or thirsty. I felt none of those things. I felt no fear because I knew nothing of which to be afraid. I felt no worry because I could remember nothing or think of nothing about which to be worried. I felt no desire to do anything that I was not doing or to have anything that I did not have because there was nothing that I wished to do and there was nothing that I wished to have. I felt only pleasure at being where I was, at seeing the wonderful light and the beautiful color around me. Once I caught sight of my face in the cockpit mirror and I saw that I was smiling, smiling with my eyes and with my mouth. And when I looked away, I knew that I was still smiling simply because that was the way I felt. Once the observer in the swordfish ahead of me turned and waved his hand. I slid back the roof of my cockpit and waved back. I remember that even when I opened the cockpit, there was no rush of air and no rush of cold or heat, nor was there any pressure of the slipstream on my hand. Then I noticed that they were all waving at each other, like children on a roller coaster, and I turned and waved at the man in the marquee behind me. But there was something happening along the line. Far up in front I could see that the aeroplanes had changed course, were wheeling around to the left and losing height. The whole procession, as it reached a certain point, was banking around and gliding downwards in a wide, sweeping circle. Instinctively I glanced down over the cockpit, and there I saw, spread out below me, a vast green plain. It was green and smooth and beautiful. It reached to the far edges of the horizon, where the blue of the sky came down and merged with the green of the plain. And there was the light. Over to the left, far away in the distance, was a bright white light, shining, bright, and without any color. It was as though the sun, but something far bigger than the sun, something without shape or form, whose light was bright but not blinding, was lying on the far edge of the green plain. The light spread outwards from a center of brilliance, and it spread far up into the sky and far out over the plain. When I saw it, I could not at first look away from it. I had no desire to go towards it, into it, and almost at once the desire and the longing became so intense that several times I tried to pull my aircraft out of the line and fly straight towards it. But it was not possible, and I had to fly with the rest. As they banked around and lost height, I went with them, and we began to glide down towards the green plain below. Now that I was closer, I could see the great mass of aircraft upon the plain itself. They were everywhere, scattered over the ground like currents upon a green carpet. There were hundreds and hundreds of them, and each minute, each second almost, their numbers grew as those in front of me landed and taxied to a standstill. Quickly we lost height. Soon I saw that the ones just in front of me were lowering their wheels and preparing to land. The Dornier next but one to me leveled off and touched down. Then the old swordfish. The pilot turned a little to the left out of the way of the Dornier and landed beside him. I turned to the left of the swordfish and leveled off. I looked out of the cockpit at the ground, judging the height, and I saw the green of the ground blurred as it rushed past me and below me. I waited for my aircraft to sink and to touch down. It seemed to take a long time. "Come on," I said. "Come on, come on." I was only about 6 feet up, but she would not sink. "Get down," I shouted. "Please,